Brigadier Calvert, Reel 1. Now, can you tell me how you came to be involved with the Mullane emergency, please?
Well, yes, I will... I was going to say some other things beforehand.
Yes?
Just after the SAS, I broke my... thigh muscle skiing in Norway, and then I got malaria, and it gave me time to think as to what my future was going to be. I was offered a job as a brigadier, and I think I was foolish in retrospect in not taking it, being an area commander in Austria. But I didn't get much good advice. All I knew was that people like General Alexander and the New Zealand VC and others who'd done well in the war had, after the 1914-18 war, where they had finished up commanding brigades, went back to, reverted to captains, junior captains in their regiments, and managed to employ themselves until they were wanted again for the Second World War. And so I thought there'd be a great reduction in the army, and that I rather anticipated going down. As also, I'd been away from the Royal Engineers for many years, and I thought that perhaps I should go back to becoming a Royal Engineer. So having seen AG7, I was posted to India with the as CRE, the 1st Indian Armoured Division, in Secunderabad. I had to reform the engineer side of this. They'd come back from the Middle East, and they were a bit of a muddle. And I had Bombay, Bengal, and Madras sappers and miners. And the officers of the squadron were very dissatisfied, having and very much pro-Middle East orientated. And so what I did, they reformed in Bangalore, and they had to move up to Hyderabad, and I told them to march up, which is a good 200 or 300 miles, and because I had to do a lot of other things in between, prepare for them, and they could use their lorries to supply themselves, and they could go across country, and it also make them get to know their men and give them a lot of initiative, and to cross lots of rivers and so on and so forth. And they did this on their own with the least amount of interference by me or my adjutant, and they came out the other end completely renewed people. They'd got to know their Indians very well, they'd got to know the villagers, they'd gone shooting, one had killed a bear, they'd never done this before, they'd done duck shooting and everything, and they got supreme confidence in themselves. And they arrived in Secunderabad, a very good unit. I won't go into what was happening in Secunderabad. The 1st Indian Armoured Division was the reserve, the Indian Army Reserve, for any revolts or mutinies anywhere in India. And their tanks had arrived by rail, and the actual roads leaving Secunderabad, going north, south, east and west, were incapable of taking these heavy tanks. And so my first job was to do a reconnaissance all over India to the routes which they could go and strengthen bridges or convert railway bridges to use by tank, by boarding them up so the tanks could go along them, or construction of simple Irish bridges or fords where the tanks could cross, where a bridge couldn't stand the weight of the tank. This, to me, was a very instructive time. I wandered all over the place. And my second in command, who unfortunately I can't remember his name, was an Indian and was a good chap. I mention his name because he kept all the records of this, of these various routes. And later, when after partition, you may remember that the Rajas and everybody tried to opt out of partition, or certain numbers of them did, and one was the Nizam of Secunderabad. And they'd built up a smart army, a large army, large parts of which were recruited in southern Arabia, and so that they'd be loyal to him. Now, he was, of course, a snob, and he was surrounded by snobs, and they, when they had any parties or anything else like that, they didn't ask the Royal Engineer. They asked the cavalry officers, but they drew a line at asking the Royal Engineers. So when I made out my secret report on the roads in all directions, I didn't send him a copy. The result was, when the Nehru decided to invade Secunderabad, the Hyderabad army manned various roads and defensive positions along their borders. And my second command, who had become CRE, he went and told the general he knew routes in which avoided their army. And they, I'm glad to say, they followed the routes I had reconnoitred and chosen and improved, and they went into, they're into Hyderabad in 2.5 days, circumventing the Hyderabad army, and the whole of the Hyderabad forces defense collapsed immediately. So it was almost a bloodless attack. I can't remember this chap's name. It isn't Kumar, but it's something like that. A well-known name, known Indian name, and he later became a lieutenant general. But he got awarded the first medal that Nehru had, the first Indian medal that Nehru had founded, and he wrote me a very nice letter saying that really you should have received this medal. I told Nehru that that it was on your routes that we came in. I was very pleased about this because I don't consider myself a particularly good engineer, and it was a very nice gesture by him.
So, in view of the Nizam's snobbish attitude, did that mean that you never actually met him in person?
Yes. I didn't play polo or anything like that. I used to ride. I rode in one or two races, point to point, but I didn't meet him. I didn't mind about this. I was very busy. I didn't want to go to the top. I never was a man for attending ceremonies. But another outcome of this was, not an outcome, but General Auchinleck was commander-in-chief, and he was worried about the defence of India from Russia. And there's going to be a study for the year, I suppose it was 1947. All this took place in 1946. And of the defence against Russia, I didn't mention Russia, in light of all the technical and tactical improvements made during the Second World War. So I formed a small mission which included a very good Royal Horse Artillery officer and Indian cavalry officer, and a party of my own sappers and miners, and we had Bedford trucks, and we had an aircraft assigned to us, and we did a reconnaissance of Baluchistan, southern Baluchistan, and all the way around the Afghan frontier, and then going up as far as Meshed, and Meshed and Herat, along the roads which had been brought up to class 70 roads at 70 tons, which had been made in 1942-43 for resupplying Russia through Karachi and Iran. We went into Afghanistan, and we also went along the coast, and I won't give you detail of this, but it's really the outcome of it was that in spite of all the improvements made, the whole line of the country swept up towards the north, towards Quetta, the plain, or plateau, which Quetta is, and that Quetta was, the defence of Quetta would stop any invasion coming from Iran or from going round Afghanistan. And there was practically no method of crossing the bare, very dry desert, high mountains between Iran and Karachi. And I think that still holds good to this day. You use the aircraft to land on various salt pans to show that these salt pans could be used as airfields. And we went along the coast to Pazni and other places which were RAF stations and which were prepared for the reinforcement of India prior to the attack on Singapore, etc., and also the return of the British soldiers back to England. Pazni in particular was completely dry, and it got all its food and supplies by air from Karachi, and it had about 200 Royal Air Force personnel who were left there, and they had nothing really to do except swim and use their jeeps in chasing deer. And they'd come down to fundamentals. They wore no clothes and just a hat and the rank penciled on their arms. It's the most extraordinary sort of lost tribe. And they'd depended on Karachi for even their films and water and everything. They were left there. Anyway, my report went up to Auchinleck and it appears to have been well received. I had asked to go to the staff college. Again, I don't know whether this is the right answer, but I was told I couldn't get high command unless I'd been through the staff college. I went to the staff college in 1947. It was a course for all those who had done well in the war but had not been through the staff college. It was a sort of refresher course in a way, but also experimental course, so they would learn as much from us as from their directing staff. And we were encouraged to give all our views about staff work and about tactics and strategy. And there were very many distinguished people there. The commandant was Richard Hull, who later became chief of the general staff. I hadn't been in Britain for long, and it was a very, very cold winter, and there was petrol rationing and so on, and I wanted to see as much of Britain as possible. I didn't take the staff college seriously enough, which I should have done, and I used very often to answer the things we were set to do by giving what I thought was the directing staff's solution, and then I'd also give my own solution. This went double work for me. This went down well with some people and not so well with others. And then our enemy always was Neuralia, and egged on by N-E-U-R-A-L-I-A, Neuralia, and egged on by a naval officer and one or two others, I formed the Trans-Neuralian Frontier Force, in which we sort of took the opposition to the directing staff in a genial way, and we had a dinner. I went up to London, got theatrical uniforms for all these people, and we had a magnificent dinner, and which we invited the directing staff and the commandant, and it was really quite well. We announced it in the Times, the Trans-Neuralian Frontier Force was holding its annual dinner, and
why do you think that you didn't take the staff college as seriously as you might have done?
Well, I suppose we thought we knew what to do. And we also, as the frontline soldier had done in 1914-18 war and anything else, we tended to rather despise the staff. Some of the staff in India really was terrible. But, of course, there were some very, very fine people. For instance, on the retreat from Burma, the AAQMG, I mean, he helped the retreat from purely his own energies and managed to feed everybody and supply everybody all on the way back. And there are some wonderful examples of magnificent staff. But there always is a tendency for the fighting soldier to draw away from the staff. It was difficult. The type of things they initially taught us to do as to how to write and put where to put in our punctuation And going back to school again, the first half of the staff college, of course, was it was staff duties, how to fill up forms and do this, that, and the other. It really was just clerk's work. The latter half was much more interesting. And I think we helped change the methods of teaching at the staff college. I met Sir Richard Hull later at White's Club, where I've been a member, and he introduced me as the man who got rid of him from the staff college because I pulled the leg so much, but he became chief of the general staff all the same. But he did acknowledge the fact that they had learnt a hell of a lot from the frontline officers who were there. And I think probably we learnt a lot. When I left there, I tried to go to the Arab Legion, and he rather jeered at me, saying, "What's a Royal Engineer wanting to command go into the Foreign Legion for? We're cavalry." And
into the Arab Legion.
The Arab Legion, yes, Arab Legion, yeah, cavalry, and that rather put me off. And eventually, I was chosen to be on Montgomery's exercise planning staff. The CIGS had an exercise. I think it was once every 2 years at that time, and this was nearly one of the last, in which all the general officers of the army gathered together with the top people in the Air Force and the Royal Navy, and we did a week's exercise at the staff college. There was a preliminary one where all the brigadiers, a large number of brigadiers came along and tested this exercise out, and we made improvements on it. And I was under Major General, the sapper officer, whom I got on with very well. And we wrote the exercise. It took us about almost 6 months. And during the exercise, I got to know Montgomery and was very impressed with him. He was a frightening personality, but he seemed to like me and my ideas, and I had a very high opinion of him. There's one point from the biographical point of view, his biographical point of view. In the mess beforehand, a lot of the officers and naval officers and others were running him down, and not a lot, but there was a certain number doing this, and were saying they didn't want to listen to him or this, that, and the other. Then when they were assembled, Montgomery calls for silence, and there was a dead silence, and he was a brilliant actor, and he managed to get, by a few remarks, this, that, and the other, to get everybody to laugh with him. And he won, in the first few sentences, he won over the whole of these very distinguished and capable officers over to his side, including the admirals and so on. And it really was the most terrific bit of showmanship. The only other bit of showmanship I'd seen similar to this was in New Zealand, when Noel Coward came out, and I knew from the New Zealanders they didn't want to listen to Noel Coward. They thought he was a poof, and so on and so forth, that he was avoiding fighting, and what did he come to teach the New Zealanders about? Well, again, Noel Coward, with a few deft sentences and remarks and jokes against himself, in 30 seconds or a minute, won over the whole audience to himself. It's a brilliant piece of showmanship.
What was the source of this kind of backbiting that people were doing behind Montgomery's back?
They thought he thought too much for himself. They thought he'd didn't take the advice of his naval officers. They thought that he'd made himself into a bit of a god, and that that he'd caused dissension with the Americans and so on like that. But I was most impressed. I can tell you an example of a bit of initiative of my own, which I'd gone down to Brighton, and there was an exhibition of drawings and paintings by a young gunner who had been prisoner of war of the Japanese in Malaya and on the Burma Railway. He'd made these drawings and paintings, mixing his own paint from, for instance, his own blood, or squeezing out leaves, or doing this, that, and the other. And they were startling paintings and drawings of what, as I put over the doorway, this is what happens if you lose. And I bought this up from Brighton. I had to pay compensation to Brighton Pier, and had it installed in a room at the Staff College, Camberley. And after a couple of days, I managed to persuade Montgomery to come in. And he stayed there for about an hour and a half talking to the young gunner. And he was so impressed by this. And that he insisted that every army officer should see them, every member attending. And he had me to make out a book with everybody's name in it, and they all had to initial it to say when they had visited this display.
Because he wanted to impress on them the consequences of defeat.
Of defeat, yes. And I also worked out, which is true, that one out of three of all the soldiers who surrendered, officers and men who surrendered to the Japanese, were either killed or died in captivity. And and when the bills came in, the War Office were incensed at having to pay Brighton Pier, and he told me to send any bills to him, and I sent them to him, and he saw to it that they were paid immediately. That was an example of him supporting a junior officer who had shown initiative, what he thought was on the right way.
But was he a man who didn't take advice from outside experts?
You didn't know. He was a frightening man because he was so knowledgeable and efficient and so on. But I was saying this in his favour, that there he was with all his great responsibilities. After all, in 1947, one's got to realise that